Thursday, December 31st, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Chad grants new rights to refugees fleeing persecution.
A major step forward to the country and the region in general.
Also ahead, tough New Year restrictions go into effect in Australia.
Tough New Year's Eve restrictions are being put in place as Australia's biggest city struggles to contain growing coronavirus clusters.
Plus, President Trump cuts short his Florida vacation as he seeks to overturn the presidential election. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Chad. The government has passed a law that grants expansive new rights to refugees fleeing persecution and hardship in neighboring countries. The new legislation is being hailed by national and international human rights and refugee aid groups, including the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. For more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the Commission's spokeswoman and operations assistant, Roberta Mantevecchi.
It's a major step forward to the country and to the region in general. Chad was the only country in the Western Africa without an asylum law.
How are refugees able to be granted asylum in Chad now? I understand there are two main ways.
Yes. One is to group refugees, which is generally the case, for example, of the Sudanese refugee and refugees that came from the Central African Republic in the past and Nigeria.
When you say a group, do you mean people from one place or people who actually cross the borders physically together into Chad?
The Refugee Convention of 1951 has to have a personal persecution story, while the African Convention speaks more about massive displacement of population across border and massive violation of human rights. So if you belong to that group, you can then be recognized as a refugee. So it's very generous. That's typical in African context.
Other things in which the law of Chad is much more generous is, for example, when it comes to the family reunification principle. Imagine in your country, my country, it will be generally limited to the nuclear family, while in Chad is extending to the extended families, which is more, I would say, fit into the African context.
What's the second major aspect to the new law?
The second part is that it provides freedom of movement of refugees, and it provides access to healthcare like a right, not just as an entitlement that can happen or not happen, and rights for education, rights to work legally, access to justice, and then family reunification also in a very broad sense. So it's really very good law at the international level and at the regional level.
Why did this law come to pass and why now?
One key moment was the Global Refugee Forum in 2019 when Chad was among the African countries that pledged for improving the legal, physical, material protection of refugees. That was most likely a trigger. And the fact that Chad was maybe the only remaining country in the Central and West Africa without an asylum law. And that is the root of these latest changes. So the law is coming to put an end to a legal vacuum. Well, I have to say that Chad is recognized to be a country with, I would say, legendary hospitality. And you know, now approximately 3% of the population of Chad is made of refugees and displaced people. So in that sense, it's really doing great. I mean, it's exemplary.
Tell me, where do most of these refugees come from?
The majority of refugees, approximately 375,000 refugees that are now in Chad, come from Sudan. Then the second biggest group, close to 97,000, are people coming from Central African Republic. And then the last group, Nigerian refugees, about 17,000.
Do these refugees go to camps mostly?
Yes. Majority of refugees now are still in the camps. But then more and more, the approach that UNHCR is advocating is breaking the boundaries between the camps and the surrounding villages in order then to be sure that whatever assistance you give to refugees will also benefit the local population. Give you an example. We built in the past health center
that were under a refugee program. But now the health center are basically transferred to the ownership of the Chadian government, and the international community is supporting this health center that provide health care to refugees and to the locals, already in a share of 60 to 40%.
This sounds like possibly a more peaceful solution in the long term. As you know, there's often competition and outright conflict between refugees and the local population of the places where they settle. It's certainly true in the U.S., where some people really resent refugees, thinking that refugees take more than their fair share of government resources and jobs.
Yes. So another example we are working on is for the vocational training. So to transfer whatever vocational training center we built to the government and then help the government to make the utmost of this center and to run them. Of course, maybe you need to help them still for some years to come, but that is broadening the access to refugees and host communities. And in that way, you will also prevent or mitigate conflict and to build on synergies rather than divide.
That is VOA's Adam Phillips speaking with Roberta Montevecchi, UNHCR's spokeswoman and operations assistant in Chad. That's my colleague Jason Patenkin speaking with VOA's Hausa Service reporter Mahmoud Lalo in Niamey. A group of influential opposition politicians in Central African Republic has called for an annulment of last Sunday's elections, saying that a third of voters were unable to cast their ballots because of insecurity. Reuters correspondent Soroya Ali reports.
Opposition politicians in the Central African Republic have called for last Sunday's election to be annulled. They say that a third of voters were unable to cast their ballot because of insecurity. The Electoral Commission said on Tuesday that around 800 of a total of 5,408 polling stations did not open because of insecurity. That's around 14%. But the group of opposition coalition, which includes five presidential candidates and former president François Bozizé, say voting was halted in over 2,000 stations, silencing a third of voters. They did not provide details on which polling stations were closed or proof to back up the claims. The nation has struggled with waves of militia violence since 2013. Armed groups vowed to march on the capital and disrupt the vote after several candidates, including Bozizé, were barred from running. Security forces managed to fend off attacks, and vote counting is now underway with the help of UN peacekeepers. Matthias Barthélemy Maruba is president of the National Election Authority.
We have started to receive votes here at this data processing center, with results from Bangui in particular. A lot of results from Bangui have arrived. About 64% of those results have already been processed.
Full provisional results are expected this week, and President Faustin Akanji Touadéra is considered the favorite in a field of 17 candidates.
That's Soroya Ali of Reuters. President Trump will be returning to the White House today, cutting short his Florida vacation ahead of next week's meeting of Congress to certify President-elect Joe Biden's victory. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
There's no official reason given for President Trump coming back to Washington a day early, but the change in plans was announced hours after Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley said he would object next week when Congress meets to affirm Joe Biden's election victory. Hawley's move would likely force a number of votes in the House and Senate that would delay the certification of Biden's win. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign filed a second request to the U.S. Supreme Court, asking that it overturn his election loss in Wisconsin, his second appeal in as many days. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
A Republican senator says he'll object when Congress meets next week to certify President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the election. VOA Steve Miller spoke with University of California Hastings College of the Law Professor Joel Poor about the process.
The electors sign ballots indicating the person to whom they are obliged by law to vote for. And those ballots will then be certified by the governor of the states. And they will be put in envelopes and they will be mailed to the vice president, who is the president of the Senate. And What then happens is that on January 6th, there's a joint session of Congress. The envelopes will be open. The vice president will read out the ballots. They will be tabulated, and they will announce that Joe Biden has a majority of the votes. Now, members of the Senate or the House can object, but under the Electoral Vote Count Act, the law provides that if the electors have been certified, that is to say, if the election has been certified as valid, those electors are presumptively valid. And so unless a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate were to vote together to reject a slate of electors, those electors' votes will count. And since a majority of the House is dominated by Democrats, and it's not at all clear that a majority of Republicans in the Senate would vote to disallow any of the electoral votes, it's pretty clear that there's no way to avoid the result that the president-elect will be Joe Biden.
Joel, what else is there to keep an eye on as this process moves forward?
I would totally expect that the proceedings on January 6th, the joint session of Congress, will include lots of heckling and objections raised by various rogue Republicans. But none of it matters. It's all just noise. And what's really going on here, I think, is an attempt to delegitimate the presidency of Joe Biden.
That's VOA Steve Miller speaking with University of California Hastings College of the Law, Professor Joel Paul. President Trump's push for additional pandemic relief aid is all but dead after Senate Republicans blocked more Democratic attempts to force a vote. AP correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
GOP Chief Mitch McConnell essentially shut the door on sending $2,000 relief checks, saying the money would go to a lot of Americans who just don't need it. For those who do, he says the Senate may consider what he calls smart targeted aid.
Not another fire hose of borrowed money.
While some Republicans back the president's push for bigger checks, many do not. And Democratic leader Chuck Schumer wonders why they picked this for their break with the president.
$2,000 checks to the American people? That is a bridge too far?
Congress had settled on $600 payments, with checks due to start going out today. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
A runoff election in the U.S. state of Georgia has profound implications for Democrat Joe Biden, who will be sworn in as U.S. president January 20th. At stake, two Senate seats that will decide the balance of power in the U.S. Congress. Mike O'Sullivan explains.
Early voting is underway in the Georgia runoff elections. Two Senate seats are at stake after none of the candidates emerged with a majority in the November election. The runoff is January 5th. Outgoing President Donald Trump has campaigned on behalf of the Republican candidates.
The voters of Georgia will determine which party runs every committee, writes every piece of legislation, controls every single taxpayer dollar.
The two races are competitive. Incumbent Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler is essentially tied in her race against Democratic candidate Raphael Warnock. The contest between Democratic candidate John Ossoff and incumbent Republican Senator David Perdue is also tight, according to polls. While Democrats continue to hold a slim majority in the House of Representatives, Republicans control the Senate. The results on January 5th could end that control in the next session, says political analyst Sherry Bebich-Jeffy.
If the Democrats can pull off two victories, there will be 50 Republicans and 50 Democrats, a tie.
And Democrat Kamala Harris, who will be sworn in as U.S. Vice President, will preside over the Senate and can break any ties to move legislation forward. President-elect Joe Biden's victory in Georgia in November reversed the southern state's past pattern of voting Republican for president. Political scientist Raphael Sonnenschein.
That was a gigantic victory for Democrats. And to have forced the two runoffs even though it's a long shot for Democrats to win both seats. It's a sign that Georgia's moving the way other parts of the South may be heading toward a new coalition.
A coalition of African Americans, whites, Asians, and Hispanics in the cities and suburbs. But the contest will be decided by who gets out the vote, says analyst Jeffy.
And the Democrats are moving strongly with regard to shoe leather campaigning, knocking on doors, even in a pandemic.
Republicans are leading in fundraising, and the final battle of a turbulent election hangs in the balance. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
This is the Voice of America. The world risks, quote, a moral catastrophe if COVID-19 vaccinations are delayed in Africa while wealthier regions inoculate their entire populations, the head of the continent's disease control body, Joan Nkengasong, said on Thursday. South Africa will have a firm date on when it will get COVID-19 vaccine in the first few days of January, a senior health ministry official told a television news channel on Thursday. South Africa is one of around 175 countries that have joined the pooled procurement for the coronavirus vaccine, commonly known as COVAX, co-led by the World Health Organization. Dozens of elderly South Korean coronavirus patients were transferred from nursing homes to hospitals this week after criticism that government policy had led to a spike in deaths among the vulnerable residents. South Korea's total tally of infections passed 60,000 on Thursday as 967 additional cases were reported. Saudi-led coalition warplanes struck targets in Yemen's Houthi-held capital Sana'a on Thursday in retaliation for attacks in the southern port city of Aden the previous day that took place as officials in a government backed by Riyadh arrived there. The coalition accused the Houthi movement, which it has been fighting for 6 years, of staging the attack on Aden's airport and a second one on the presidential palace. Dutch charity ZOA said one of its employees had been killed at a refugee camp in the northern Tigray region of Ethiopia, where the military has been fighting rebel forces. The charity said in a statement on Wednesday that a 52-year-old worker was killed in Hisatz refugee camp. He had worked for the charity for 10 years and lives a wife and seven children.
This is Science in a Minute.
On May 22nd, NASA's Neil Gehrels Swift Observatory detected a quick but powerful burst of gamma rays. Scientists, led by Northwestern University, say the bright burst released more energy in just a half a second than our sun has and will throughout its 10 billion year lifespan. They observed the burst's afterglow in optical, X-ray, near-infrared, and radio wavelengths with several ground-based telescopes and the Hubble Space Telescope. After analyzing observational data, the team found that they may have witnessed the birth of a magnetar, a fast-rotating neutron star with a powerful magnetic field. The team says they believe this magnetar was produced by the merger of two neutron stars in a galaxy some 5.4 billion light-years away. They say when two neutron stars merge, a black hole, not a magnetar, is usually produced. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Iran-backed factions in Iraq are increasing their threats against Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi and President Barhan Saleh as arrest warrants were issued for three military personnel from the Iraqi Hezbollah and a civilian involved in launching missiles against diplomatic and military headquarters. As tensions are on the rise between the government and pro-Iran militias, the Iraqi Prime Minister sent an envoy to Iran with a message that Iraqi government's patience is growing very thin regarding pro-Iran militias' behavior in Iraq. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi discussed these developments with Ismail Al-Sudani, former Iraqi military attaché to the U.S.
It's normal to hear that the militias are threatening the prime minister or president or even the legal or judicial system in Iraq. They want to impose their agendas, which contradict with the state conceptions and discipline. In fact, these militias, supported by their political parties, are trying to control the political and security scene inside Iraq and become exempt from legal liability. So the confrontation between those militias and the security forces is inevitable, and this confrontation that will take a military shape has to take place in Iraq in order to curb their militias or their power under the state control.
Would the Iraqi government yield to such threats?
They are humiliating the power of the prime minister and the government. And people start feeling that these militias are above the state and above the law. And the government will be yielding to them for their demands. They are using some pretenses and manipulating that being involved in the fight against ISIS to attract the support of the people. Now they are losing that support from the people, and they will be without a popular support like ISIS when they have lost their social support from their supporters. So I think these militias, because they are acting out of the control of the state, they are losing the popularity among the people. And at the end of the day, the government will be more strong to confront them.
As tension is on the rise between the government and pro-Iran militias, Iraqi Prime Minister sent an envoy to Iran with a message that Iraqi government's patience is growing very thin regarding pro-Iran militias' behavior in Iraq. Would Iran calm down its proxies in Iraq?
Iran does not want these militias to collide with the government. On the other hand, they want them to undertake their agendas and deliver its message to the United States inside Iraq. At the same time, it would like to maintain good relations with the Iraqi government to keep the diplomatic ties at the highest level. So Iran's position is very complicated, but definitely it can control and stop these militias, but it does not want to. Therefore, Iran policies in Iraq have been undertaken by two significant groups. The radical group are controlled by the Revolutionary Guard, and they control these militias, while the diplomatic ties is controlled by the government. And that is the dilemma that everyone inside Iraq is watching and seeing these problems. I see that Iran is very influential player inside Iraq, and they can control on these militias.
What are the possible scenarios for U.S.-Iraqi relations under a Biden administration?
Since the situation in Iraq has not been changed, I don't think we will see a drastic change in the U.S.-Iraq relation unless the Iraqi government could sustain its control and their grip on the security situation and subdue the militias in a way that keeps them under the government check and discipline. The relations, if the government failed to do that, ties between Iraq and the United States wouldn't be as good as today, maybe. I don't think Iraq will be able, in the near term at least, to control these militias. Oh, until that time, the United States also would like Iraq to be more powerful, because Iraq for the United States is the forefront to confront Iran, and do not want Iran to expand their power to the region and to threat Israel and the American interest in the region.
That's VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy speaking with Ismail Al-Sudani, former Iraqi military attaché to the U.S. Pope Francis will not lead New Year's Eve and New Year's Day services because of a flare-up in his sciatica condition, which produces pain in one of his legs, the Vatican said on Thursday. It was the first time in years that Francis, who turned 84 this month, has had to skip a papal event for health reasons. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mohamed Ibarra, our colleague, Jason Patinkin, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I'm Chinedu Okoye in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a happy, healthy New Year.